TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. This is a story about corn. This is part two. Corn is essential to our survival. It's the second most important grain after rice. It feeds people and animals and is an ingredient in most processed foods. Corn is made into sugar, oil, or automobile fuel, and is even used in dyes, paints, and chemicals. Corn and corn silk are used in healing. Not surprisingly, biotechnology companies have engineered corn, either by making it resistant to herbicides or insects. The health effects on us are still unknown, mainly because they're not investigated. However, a study done at Cornell University showed that monarch butterflies have a high death rate when eating pollen from genetically engineered corn. Almost half of all corn grown and eaten in the U.S. is genetically engineered, the highest percentage anywhere in the world. Our neighbor Mexico, for example, does not allow any engineered corn to be planted for fear that it would contaminate their precious stocks of ancient indigenous corn. From the beginning, the industry has claimed that genetically engineered corn was non-toxic as well as stable, that it would not cross-pollinate with organic corn. That claim was shattered when researchers from the University of California, Berkeley, found that contamination had reached the cradle of corn, the remote Oaxacan villages of the Zapotecan Indians, in spite of the Mexican ban on planting. The story of that discovery was published in the science magazine of record, Nature. It shook the world and made headlines in major European papers. It left the Zapotecan Indians with a deep sense of betrayal. For over 10,000 years, through droughts and wars, they had kept their precious corn alive. They protected it from invading Aztecs, Spaniards, and even Mexico City developers, only to find that this invasion of their corn came with stealth, invisible. A tiny bacteria had entered the DNA of their plants. Somebody had rewritten the blueprint of their corn. When Monsanto, the giant chemical company that has major investments in biotechnology, heard about the discovery, they suggested that the Zapotecan Indians pay them royalties. People familiar with the case of the Canadian farmer Percy Schmeiser know that this is not just adding insult to injury, but a serious threat. Schmeiser, a canola breeder and seed collector, found his fields contaminated by Monsanto's Roundup Ready canola. Monsanto sued for patent right infringement and was awarded the revenue from that year's harvest. Schmeiser is appealing the decision to the Canadian Supreme Court. In part one of this program, you heard the story of the discovery of the contamination of the Zapotecan corn, as told by Ignacio Chapela. He's assistant professor at the Department of Environmental Science at the University of California, Berkeley. He has worked with the Zapotecan Indians for 15 years. The discovery of the contamination was made by him and his grad student, David Quist. In this part of the program, we will talk about false promises and even the question if engineering of plants and animals will eventually affect our own bodies, our own DNA. We began by talking about patenting and why a corporation should even acquire property rights for a seed by making a small and crude change in the existing DNA. Here's Ignacio Chapela.
One of the main policymakers in biotech from the European Union asked the question, do we have a technology here? Do we have anything to patent here? Are we talking of anything that we could call a technology at all? And the answer, the honest answer from a biological perspective is no. There is nothing here that you can patent. What you have done is you have learned how to insert yourself or your little interest into the game of life, into the main course of life. And you're tumbling around in this course, and you think that you know what you're doing, when in reality it's absolutely not true. A technology is something that allows you to put a blueprint on paper and say, this is going to be a VW Beetle. And then you follow that blueprint and you get a VW Beetle and you turn the key and it does something that you know it's going to do, and it just takes you wherever you want to go. And you know how to fix it, and you know how to, you know, that is a technology. There's nothing comparable to that in biotechnology, in fiddling with life. What we do is a very, very rudimentary, crude attempt at getting living organisms to do what we tell them to do. What makes people so arrogant, I believe, who can get away with saying, oh, I did this, and therefore I produced this mouse who glows in the dark and who does this thing that will do what I tell it to do, is, again, just a testament to the power of life, to the enormous capacity of life to take in its stride. Even these crazy alterations of what life usually does. So it has nothing to do with the power of the technologist trying to alter the course of that, but actually with the course of that living thing taking in its stride the enormous assault. How can you patent something that you don't even know you're doing? How can you patent something whose mechanism you have never described, or even you could never even dream of understanding at this point, which is really the honest situation that we are in biology today?
It's interesting for me to hear that a European person would call this a technology, so that's the definition of patent right there. And it's very similar to here, machines, mm-hmm. really heavy philosophical concept that the patenting of life asserts life as machine.
There is so much about biotechnology that really is, I think, a very cheap attempt at sequestering or piggybacking on the enormous success of things like electronics technology or even nuclear technology, the particle physics advances and so on. But a quarter century into it, there isn't a single product of biotechnological manipulations that one can speak of in the same terms. There is nothing that is not even conceivably with the potential of a recorder or a personal computer or a pager or anything like that in biotechnology that, you know, a normal citizen would like to have and would be willing to pay money for. There's nothing like that coming from this manipulation of lives. I think there's just so much hubris and arrogance in all this that gets denied over and over and over again every time a seed germinates, every time, you know, an animal is born, every time something actually works in the living world. That arrogance and that hubris is denied. You know, we're still working. It's still running. We are pushing it. We're really trying. We're really pushing it to the edge. But there is just an enormous resilience that I think is, yes, it's good news. Might not be very good news to us as humans, but it's in general good news if what you like is life.
I wish I was as optimistic about it, because some of the urgency that I wanted this meeting to happen comes from this enormous crime, really, to contaminate, put things into nature that can never be recalled, that go on. Yes, hopefully they won't be stable. Hopefully these genes will be silenced, as that's a famous expression already. That's beautiful. That can be done by a plant to reject. But it's out there. It is like really the mythological thing about sending something in motion that you have no power over, like nuclear power.
I think both points of view are not contradictory. I think what Barbara is talking about is good news from an almost cosmological point of view, where we might disappear, but there will be life. And I really don't think that we're going to be able to finish life off. Maybe with nuclear power, we we could just basically cook the planet and that would be it. With biotechnology, I don't think we will. It's not a question of whether there will be life or not. It's a very different question to what, you know, Russell and Einstein were confronted with. Are we going to cook ourselves? Are we going to just simply finish life on Earth? And I don't think we're confronted with that question right now. I think what we're confronted with is a very humanistic question. It's a very human-centered question of whether we want to be here and whether we want to be here as we know ourselves, as we like to think of ourselves as a civilized society. That is very much at stake. So when you talk about the challenge of the contamination of crops, the contamination of centers of diversity and so on, that is a very serious challenge, but it's a challenge to human diversity. It's a challenge to human sustainability. It's a challenge to our ability to reliably get food. And I don't think humanity is going to disappear for lack of food. We might kill a good proportion of ourselves, but there will be humans to eat whatever is left over. And even if humans disappear, there will continue to be many organisms that will be pretty happy when we go away and change. So I think the question is very different. The optimism, I think, is cosmological. The pessimism is humanistic. And I'm very much with both.
Ignacio, can you just speak briefly to what I imagine would be the response by the sales force of biotechnology, which is that there's nothing so far that anybody would want to go into a supermarket and say, yes, I want, you know, GM tomatoes, right? But what they're hoping and what they're promising, of course, is that the next generation of, nutraceuticals, namely, you know, that there's going to be the banana with the vaccine. I take it that you'd make the same case that these are very crude interventions which, relatively speaking, are going to fall in upon themselves.
Yeah, I believe that very deeply. From what I know and from what I see where we're going, the foundations of what we're doing, I wouldn't have any hope that these manipulations are really going very far in. Anyway, however, that doesn't mean that from the humanistic point of view, they're not pervasive. That human culture and human survival even is not under threat from these things. No matter how in the course of evolution, no matter how temporary these alterations might be, from our point of view, they're I think very deep and very significant. There is one argument that is often hard to defeat, which is the argument of relieving human suffering. Mm-hmm. You know, we are moving in the second and third generation of biotech products to a point where we are relieving human suffering. At that point, it is possible to take pictures of faces to put in, you know, Time magazine or some, you know, place like that, where you have an individual whose suffering is being relieved by these technologies. And just the promise of that becomes such a powerful thing to just stop questioning. You're not allowed to question lest you're told that you are promoting the suffering of this little kid in Mexico, because you're not delivering the vaccine, or you're not delivering the nutraceutical, or you're not delivering this second, third generation biotech product. And I think that connects with the question of scale and the question of time, where you say, okay, the suffering of an individual, just the promise of relieving suffering from an individual who isn't even here, because we don't have anything to deliver this right now or for one or two generations, compared with the prolonged and incremental suffering of humanity for the loss of diversity, for the loss of cultural identity and diversity, for the loss of even a reliable food source. How can we put on the balance, you know, this promise for a smiley face, this one individual, against humanity, against culture, against much larger questions? But of course, it's a lot harder to put this in Time magazine. it's a lot easier to just put a, you know, a sad and smiley face before and after, you know, like in those ads. I mean, the reality is that nobody cares about whether children die in Guatemala or not. Nobody cares. I think there, it's very important to recognize that what we're talking about here is transformations that have biosphere scale implications that extend over a very long time and over very large populations and over many generations. I mean, are we going to be really celebrating, no matter how, at what cost, the, you know, the smiley face of this kid who was saved disease, at no matter what cost to humanity? I don't think I would.
What could one mean by contamination beyond the profound cultural implications for the people of Oaxaca?
The least complicated answer, you say, well, all we did was to show that there is connectivity between industrial and landrace corn. I'm amazed that people have tried to deny this, because the answer that I would have if I was a propagandist of this technology would be to say, well, so what? I think it's really important anyway, because it shows that something that you do in Iowa in a laboratory is going to sooner or later find its way to the Zapotec Mountains in Oaxaca. And by the same token, a little bit deeper, it's going to find its way to my genome. So the transformation of corn in an Iowa laboratory is, in a very real physical, technical sense, a transformation of the human genome, admittedly a few generations down the line. But it's true that all genomes are connected in biology. You know, over evolutionary time, we are all connected in a very real sense, in a very physical sense. So it's not as trivial as it would seem. Yes, of course, if you are thinking of, you know, 1, 2, 10 generations of humans, that is not a problem. And then we say, well, it's a risk. You know, I'm going to go to Phil Campbell's level and talk about this movie Shrek, when you have the dictator say, and I'm going to send you to find my princess and fight for her, and of course many of you are going to die, but it's a risk I'm willing to take. You know, it's the same position that we in this generation are very willing to take risks for 10 generations down the line. So who cares if they get contaminated with corn manipulations that were done in Iowa in 2002? I think there is a new sense of social justice that biotechnology brings that has to do with intergenerational responsibility that environmentalists had already established many years ago, but biotechnologists are establishing in a very real physical sense. The transformations of life that we're doing today are having major repercussions into the future. There are so many things that we do not know, and it's this unknown part of it that we should really be worrying about what we're doing, what we're releasing out there, and what our own descendants are going to be facing these 10 generations down the line when they meet the transformations that we've introduced into corn. In a very real physical sense, in their own genomes. What is going to happen? We have no idea.
I wanted to be sure we talk about you a little bit, because you've talked about ideas and history, but you are at the vortex of it right now. Your job is at stake. People have tried to bribe you, and people have tried to threaten you. So you belong into the story.
There are really unprecedented things about what's happened around that story that carries my name with it. The fact that the scientific establishment in the form of this Nature magazine would do something unprecedented in its 133-year history tells me that there is something very serious about what's happening out there and about the questions that have not been asked. I think it's not about the question that we asked, it's about all the questions that were not asked. And then how the scientific establishment has had to go into high gear to discredit, to by any means possible, get rid of the story, finish it off, say, this is it, we give closure, everybody go home, nothing happened here. And how they were willing to play this totally unusual role as, you know, judge and jury and executioner, all rolled into one, and actually one individual, the editor of Nature, who I happen to know as a very intelligent and actually quite thoughtful person. What are the forces out there that all of a sudden conjured up this action at this crux in history, at this crux in time, in the development of these technologies, in the development of what is this so-called globalized market and globalized world? If you can derail the whole ag biotech machinery, and to a large extent the whole scientific establishment machinery, because it actually is what happened, with $2,000 worth of work, there's something seriously wrong with it, I think. I think the most interesting thing for me is that the story continues to roll, because that means that people are just tired of having the wool pulled over their eyes. The fact that people are interested in the story is, again, not something about the story itself, but about the fact that we've had so much of denying that nothing is happening, denying that people have anything to say, leaving the questions to the experts, and not allowing anybody to ask questions about what the consequences are of our actions internationally. You know, you are like, oh, it's okay if you think about what your actions are here in Berkeley and in California and so on, but don't ask any questions about what your feeding habits have to do with Rwanda. Right? I think people are fed up with that, and people want change. The main story is not about me. It's not about corn. It's not about, not even about humanity's food source. It's about the takeover of something that we hold very dear, which is a democratic society and a representative society and a society that is more or less, you know, for better or for worse, led by reason, and how this being hijacked and the mechanisms through which it's being hijacked. And that seems to be the most interesting story for people who are asking questions these days.
That was Ignacio Chapela, Assistant Professor of Microbial Ecology at the University of California, Berkeley. He wrote a report for the science magazine of record, Nature, on the contamination of the Zapotecan corn in Oaxaca, Mexico. Unprecedented in its over 100-year history and apparently pressured by a huge campaign by the biotech industry, the magazine tried to make him retract his findings. Chapela and his grad student, David Quist, stood by their work. The findings were confirmed by other labs. And this is where the meeting ended. Chapela, three friends of mine, including the writer and historian Ian Bull, had met in a Berkeley bookstore. But as I went home, one comment by Ignacio Chapela haunted me. What exactly did he mean when he said that these changes made to corn could eventually affect our human genome as well? Here's his answer.
The question was, how could we see these manipulations of transgenic manipulations of DNA in other species come back to humans? And I see two ways. One, which is the biological route, which is totally speculative but not implausible and not unlikely, and that is a process called horizontal gene transfer. We know that we are connected with the rest of, you know, DNA-based, carbon-based life over evolutionary time. You know, when Haeckel and Darwin and those people were thinking of evolution, they used to think of evolution as a continuously expanding tree with branches always diverging away from each other. You have pure lines that are just always getting purer and purer and kind of diverging away from them. DNA work, this molecular biology knowledge has helped us realize that that's not really the case, the way evolution happens. There is a lot of what's called reticulation, where you have feedback movement of genetic material from one of these branches to the other. So what we have is really a net of life, of interconnected life. The rate of movement is very low, especially for organisms like ourselves that are really good at telling self from non-self and really good at pushing out bacteria that come into your body and so on. But, I mean, some of you might be surprised that you are actually, every one of your cells is actually made not of a cell that you can call, you know, pure Aryan or whatever your race might be, but it's actually made of your cells or the cells of your ancestors plus bacteria that have been incorporated into it through evolutionary time that you call your mitochondria. Those mitochondria really evolved from or are the descendants of a totally different evolutionary lineage than the other part of your ancestors, you know, so they met at some point. So there are roots through which we should expect over evolutionary time to see the interconnectedness of life operate like that. I think there are much better, much easier ways of thinking about this question, and that is how it is that we are using the technology to transform humans. And I know that tonight we've been talking a lot about ag biotech and that a lot of public attention goes to ag biotech and biotech in the environment, but the technology itself denies the difference between humans and non-humans. That's the whole point of the technology. So there are incredible advances out there that are pointing to or are aiming at transforming the human genome by incorporating either pieces from other humans but also pieces from other organisms or producing pigs that will carry proteins, that human proteins or human genes and express that. So we are trying, we are really working at erasing the difference between between species in the lab.
That was the story of corn as told by Ignacio Chapella, assistant professor of microbial ecology at the University of California, Berkeley. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on Ignacio Chapella on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information how to order a copy of this conversation with Ignacio Chapella by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. Time of Useful Consciousness is an aeronautical term. The time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for the pilot to save the plane. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.